This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, your 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, your 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century history guy.
This problem is bigger than the individual states. It's a grave national problem, and it touches all our lives. With a problem so clear-cut and the proven solution at hand, we have no misgiving about this judicious use of federal power.
That was President Reagan back in July of 84. That grave national problem he was talking about? Budget deficit? Nuclear weapons? Guess again. He was talking about drinking and driving.
The clip is from the signing of the National Minimum Drinking Age Act, which effectively raised the drinking age to 21. Fast forward 24 years, and the drinking age is again in the news.
Welcome back. It's College Week on American Morning, and today we're taking a look at a serious issue on campuses, underage drinking.
It doesn't the drinking just age go from 21 to 18.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving joined with other groups in Washington, D.C. yesterday to keep the drinking age at 21. They say the law has prevented some
more than 100 college and university presidents have come out this year in favor of revisiting the drinking age. They say binge drinking is a major problem on campus despite the age limit, and that decriminalizing underage drinking may be the first step towards controlling it.
Now, we history guys are going to remain agnostic on that one, especially considering that Ed here is a university president when he's not being one of our history guys. But we did think we had something to add to the discussion, a little history.
Each week on Backstory, we pluck a topic from the headlines and spend an hour exploring its history. This week, our topic is alcohol. How have Americans treated drink in the past? Why did temperance become fashionable? And when did the government get involved in all of this? And I got a question for you, Peter. Why is there a beer named after one of our founding fathers?
Well, Brian, before we get to Sam Adams, I want to go back even earlier, all the way back to 1587, to the first ill-fated attempt at English settlement off the coast of Virginia. There's a guy named Ian Gately who's written a new book about the history of drinking, and he told me that part of the attraction of America for those settlers was that they'd be able to live a healthy life there, free from the boozy temptations of London. Well, that didn't work out too well.
A Spanish spy went up to have a look, and his report said, you know, that they're all sickly because they have to drink water, which is quite contrary to the English spirit.
Right.
And, you know, the administrators looked at it, and they said it was an inexcusable error to plant a colony by water drinkers.
So he's saying that if these guys had just kept drinking liquor, they wouldn't have all died off.
Yeah, well, you know, the obvious explanation for this is that water was dirty. It was the source of disease. People died because they drank it, particularly in Virginia, where it was brackish water. It was much more sensible to go to New England, where there's a lot of clean, good water. But keep in mind, they drank a lot in New England, too. This is a period in American history when people drink, 10 to 15 times as much per capita.
Yeah,
as
so you're saying they're a bunch of drunks, Peter.
Well, yeah, they drank a lot. John Adams, every morning he wakes up, and the first thing he does to clear the old cobwebs is he pours himself a big glass of hard cider.
So, Peter, if even the founding fathers were drunks, when did this all become sinful and immoral? How did that happen?
Americans did become concerned in the Enlightenment revolutionary period, worried about the future of the republic, which depended on responsible good citizens. And since so many Americans were drunk at that time, working people, it became a challenge for not only republican citizenship, but labor discipline and control. There was a general feeling that if things were going to improve in America, and the whole point of America was improvement, then we had to stop drinking so much. And this is the beginnings of the temperance movement. But it's a slippery slope. If a lot of it's bad, isn't a little bit of it bad too?
Yeah, but I'll bet a lot of it was needed to get people to go fight in the Civil War. Am I wrong, Ed?
Alcohol was a big help in getting people to fight for the Civil War. It's illegal to ship alcohol to your loved ones, but you'll find letters and people sort of say, look in the pocket of your pants that I sent you. And they know that it could be a great comfort on, you know, an incredibly lonely time when you're sitting there in some camp throughout the winter waiting to die in the spring. But temperance people come talk to these people who are also looking for solace. So it's a supercharged environment for alcohol consumption and alcohol
restriction.
Well, Ed, you know, those temperance folks didn't go away after the Civil War. In fact, they picked up steam. And a little while ago, Peter and I sat down with Jim Marrone, a political scientist up at Brown University. He's written about the politics of sin. And one of the things he told us was that the key players in the second half of the 19th century were women on this issue, specifically the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
It starts out pretty mildly. In 1873, a bunch of women at a small town in Ohio, Washington Courthouse, a town of 2,000 people, and as far as I can tell, about 20 saloons. The women knelt outside the saloons, hoping that the saloon keepers would see the light. And indeed, many of them see these women sitting there singing hymns and praying. They began to shut down the saloons, and that caused a ripple through the national consciousness.
So is this one of the first instances of participatory democracy of sorts?
Yes. Yes, and it is a very interesting instance of participatory democracy because it's organized by women.
Maybe you could explain why exactly women would be so upset about this issue. What's the women's stake in this?
Now, I've got two answers to that. One is that some people believe, and in some places it clearly was true, that drinking was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a way to protect the home from men who would get drunk and squander family wages. I think the other part of it is remember what else is happening in the society. This is becoming an era of very high immigration. Immigrants drank. And this was a way of good – another way. There are many ways in American history. We know we can see it today. But this was a fantastic way for people to raise themselves up above these very dubious immigrants from questionable places with – poor values. This was a way of saying American values are truly special. We really are a city on a hill, and we can organize ourselves around these things that really make us good and distinguish those people in the cities.
So, Jim, you've talked about ethnicity as a divide that can emerge in debates about drinking. How about race? How does race figure in the temperance movement?
Race is the other really big one, and I think it's the most overlooked piece of this, and it takes place in the South. The great metaphor, the great trope at the turn of the century is, of course, the rape narrative. The black men rape white women, and that's why Jim Crow has to go into effect to control this group that's not ready for the kinds of freedoms that America affords males. Now, there was a basic problem with this, that the black people, most people knew, didn't play the part of this rapacious, fearsome black male that's such an important part of the stereotype. And the missing piece was liquor. If you read the literature coming out of the 19th century, late 19th century, South, over and over again, you see there is descriptions the black man drinks alcohol, and that makes him a fiend. In fact, there was a lot of talk about outlawing pictures of women on alcohol bottles because it was said that the black man would see the white woman on her picture and would go rape the nearest white woman. It was said that why was there so much lynching in the South in the 1890s? Alcohol. So there was this great argument that black men under the influence of alcohol, so they weren't like the black guys you knew who were really quite
differential.
And they
weren't worried about the lynch mob being liquored up.
Well, they
were worried about the black man being liquored up.
Very much. Very, very much. But two things to say about this. One is the truth about black people is that they're the swing vote in temperance votes insofar as black men are still voting. And remember, they're still voting till 1896 in large numbers. They divide into people who say, don't be ridiculous, we like to drink, and the church-based prohibitionists among the black vote. So that for a political scientist, what's fascinating is here in an era when they're trying to constrain African Americans, on one issue, they're the swing vote. And if you can convince the black churches to mobilize, you can actually get temperance in your county. This is not something that white elites want to be happening.
Right.
Then what finally brings this to a head, this is the second point, the Atlanta race riot, this terrible race riot in September 1906. The Atlanta newspapers get guys all jimmied up. Some woman had been assaulted by an unknown black assailant, probably liquored up. This is in the newspaper articles if you go back and look at them. And the claim on the sub-headline is, what's wrong with our men? Can they no longer protect Southern white women? There is a horrible race riot. Young men ran through the streets, took black men off trains, out of businesses, beat them up, killed an unknown number. The progressive elites now step in and say, you know, it's not just the black guys who drink. It's the white guys. It's the lower class whites who drink too. The Atlanta race riot pushed everybody over the top and said, we just have to forbid all alcohol in Georgia. Georgia goes first, and one after another, the southern states go dry. And they go dry in arguments about race, right as Jim Crow goes into place.
Now, let me stop you there, because you've just touched on one of the great enigmas in this story of temperance. Almost everything that the three of us have talked about up till now is a very local story, maybe state level at the most. Yet, in the early 20th century, we get national prohibition. Explain how we can get from such a historically localistic story to such a powerful use of the national government.
That's exactly the right question. Your county is dry. What's the problem? Why do you need to go national? One piece is, it was hard to stay dry if there were other states that were wet. So that if you, Georgia, went dry, for example, it was very hard to stop the guy up on the hill from ordering a keg of whiskey from Ohio because interstate commerce is part of the Constitution. But all of that would not have been enough to get us, I don't think, to prohibition if one last thing hadn't fallen into place, World War I. There's a fascinating – if you ever want to do some fascinating reading, look at the graduation addresses in 1917 and 1918 as the college presidents and the speakers look at the boys who are going to be the officers in the American Army. They all say the same thing. They say these boys are going to be an army hitherto unseen in history. They will not give in to the seductions of the women in the cities of Europe, nor will they give in to drink. They will be the first truly Christian army in history. And as one of the presidents put it, patriotism must mean prohibition. Now the forces of the wets, who lived in the Northeast, had a huge burden. They had to not only defend drinking and immigrants, they had to say why they were resisting the great Christian army. And it was in war fervor and in the sort of fervor of being the great Christian nation that prohibition goes over the top and actually becomes the law.
That's Brown University political scientist Jim Marone.
This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf, historian of early America.
I'm Ed Ayers, the historian of the century that followed.
And I'm Brian Ballow. If it didn't happen too long ago, I'm your guy. We're talking today about the history of alcohol in America.
When we left off, political scientist Jim Marone was telling Brian and Peter about the temperance movement of the late 19th and early 20th century and how World War I paved the way for all-out prohibition. The 18th Amendment, which banned the sale of alcohol, was ratified in 1919 and went into effect a year later.
In hindsight, prohibition kind of looks like a colossal failure. I mean, think about it. All those speakeasies, bootleggers, gangsters. It sure seems like drinking was very much alive and well in the 1920s. But Jim Marone says that at the time, a lot of Americans were 100% behind this policy. As a matter of fact, 8 years into Prohibition, Herbert Hoover ran for president on a dry platform, and he trounced the candidate of the so-called wets, New York Governor Al Smith. Here's Marone again.
Al Capone's out there. Crime is out there. Murder is out there. At the same time, you've got a lot of Americans, a majority probably, but certainly a lot of rural Americans, taking great pride in what the federal government is trying to do and seeing it as noble. For the first time, they really felt the touch of federal government as a kind of spiritual cause. People like to say that the New Deal is the father of big government. That's nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
The father of big government is prohibition.
This is the way that big government becomes legitimate in the countryside. I think that's really fascinating.
That's the lost story in here, isn't it? So what happens to all this? What happens is the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Hoover goes around in his campaign saying, do you notice something? Do you notice that we're in the greatest period of prosperity in American history? We know that he was exaggerating a little bit. But it was a great period of prosperity. Now why? He said, we've stopped drinking. That's why we're in such prosperity.
Right.
Do you know that men are more handsome? Have you noticed that American men are more handsome and American women more beautiful? And so in the late it's a great campaign speech, right? We're more prosperous. We're more handsome. Who's going to vote against that? And then the Depression hits. Well, the Depression makes everything associated with the Republicans, associated with Hoover, absolutely poisonous. And there's also an economic argument here. During World War I, starting in 1913 but becoming popular in World War I, we begin to rely on the federal income tax. The income tax can now fund the federal government. What did it replace? What it replaced was tariffs and taxes on alcohol. So all of a sudden, Roosevelt comes into office. He needs that tax on alcohol because the income tax has gone through the floor. And they don't have revenues.
Right.
If you look at the original National Recovery Administration, if you actually read the law, what does it say? It says that as soon as prohibition is repealed, we'll use the tax on alcohol to fund the NRA.
But Jim, taking the long view, we certainly drink a lot less than Americans did during the early Republic. And you could say that prohibition initiated a period of concern about public health in the broadest sense of the term. And the changes have been enduring ones.
And that the national government remained quite active in those issues from that point on.
Well, all those things you just said are absolutely right on. And to add to Brian's last point, one thing that was very interesting during all this was that we had to decide what the Constitution said about the federal government going in there and getting this involved in people's lives. Fourth Amendment says that people must be secure in their personal property and themselves, that the government cannot do search and seizure. Fourth Amendment law gets rewritten around prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
May you wiretap someone's house. Is that the same thing as breaking in and rifling through their papers?
Right.
You see a known bootlegger driving back to Detroit from Windsor, Ontario. You're a cop. You turn around. You give chase. You stop him. You rip his seats out. What's there? Of course, cases of booze. Well, was that a legal stop or not? Cars were relatively new. So all the rules and regulations that we now use in our drug wars went into effect during Prohibition. So the echo of Prohibition lives on.
Yeah, for better or worse. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Brian and Peter, lots of fun. And thank you for having me on. And next time, maybe we can talk more about sex.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye, Jim.
Jim Marone is a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History. You can find out more about his book at backstoryradio.org.
The decisive vote of the 36th state against prohibition is happy news for the grain raisers of the United States and for many others throughout the land. With an eye on December 5th, work is being rushed in distilleries and bottling works. Thousands are being called back to work in plants of allied industries. At least 500,000 new jobs are predicted as the result of repeal. From keg and barrel factories, perhaps the most closely allied line, immediate benefits from repeal extend into almost every line of business and commerce. However, everyone's not waiting until December 15th. The lid is off in many places, with the downfall of prohibition being celebrated in real old-time hilarity. Yes, and by the renewal of old acquaintances. Hotels, bars and nightclubs report a real pre-war spirit among those revelers. Boy.
That was Universal Newsreel reporting the repeal of Prohibition 75 years ago this December.
Well, you know, that is really interesting, guys. The idea that Prohibition was not just this sort of anomaly, just sort of a blip in American history, but really absolutely fundamental to defining a lot that came after.
Well, think about it, Ed. I mean, he's saying that all the things the government did, the FBI, rules about search and seizure, I mean, all this stuff that we live with today is kind of an enduring legacy of Prohibition.
Yeah, it's interesting because we often use it as an example to say, well, that just shows the limits of federal power.
Just the beginning. Yeah,
you can't legislate morality. Well, actually, it turns out you can. Matter of fact, people have been trying to do it ever since.
Listeners, we want to know what you think about all this. Was repeal of Prohibition the end of an era, or was it just the beginning? Leave us a comment at backstoryradio.org. Now, I think it's time for a phone call. What do you say, guys?
Sure, let's do it to it.
We got Lauren on the line. She's calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Lauren, this is a particularly interesting topic. How do you come to an interest in alcohol?
Well, actually, what I wanted to ask you about is today we think about kind of controlling the morality of people as a very conservative type of movement, and yet temperance was one of many progressive reforms.
Oh, that's a terrific point.
That's a great point. You know, were kind of considered liberal at that time.
Yeah. Why do you think it was considered progressive?
Well, because they were trying to improve people's lives. And
exactly.
I guess, what was considered conservative was things that were more letting things take their course. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly it. People felt that liquor ruined people's lives. It did ruin not only the lives of the men who fell under its sway, but the reformers were even more concerned with the women and children who suffered as a result of it. Wages lost, spouses abused, to use today's language. It did destroy a lot of families. And then there was a great concern about destroying political independence. Votes were bought with alcohol. It was seen as corrupting American virtue and independence. I think you make a great point. These were all progressive causes. You know,
Point I would make, though, is that it's a really partisan movement. And I'm talking about being progressive, it's Republican. And it does have a strong overlay of nativism and of evangelicalism. So it is a particular kind, and maybe, you know, the most widespread of all progressive reforms. But it's not something that was, you know, embraced with the same bipartisan support, I don't think. I think it would have been identified as a kind of, if we think of a restrictive progressivism as opposed to a liberating progressivism.
Right. But Ed, and so you might say, Ed, that temperance reform, prohibition were efforts to reshape American society in the absence of powerful social institutions, safety nets, welfare, and so forth, so that what we call modern liberalism is maybe laissez-faire with respect to behavior, but we have all kinds of institutions that guarantee social stability and public health and so forth. So there may be a continuity between the progressivism of these Yankee reformers, and that's what they were basically, and the modern welfare reformers.
Well, and of course, the real continuity, and Ed put his finger on it by talking about the 19th century partisan divide, but the strongest continuity is that of a willingness to turn to the state, to eventually the national government, in order to intervene in people's lives, something that ironically today, Lauren, has been taken up by the conservatives.
I want to ask my fellow guys, and you too, Lauren, if you'd like to participate, a quiz.
Okay.
So the question is, where did ABC stores come from and when?
I'm not sure what an ABC store is.
Well, there you go.
Well, that's taking an easy way out.
That's what we call alcohol beverage control, is
control.
That? In Virginia, liquor, hard liquor, is only sold in state-run stores.
Yes, I was raised in Arizona, and liquor is in just normal stores there. But here in Michigan, it's the same way. It's only in certain, they call them party stores, which I think is very funny.
Party stores.
That seems to give a bad idea.
I walk in there and I'm expecting balloons and party hats because that's what a party store is in Arizona.
You know, that's funny, but it's not answering my question.
No,
Ed, I would, if I had a guess,
come on.
I would guess during the progressive era, actually, as there was increased pressure for temperance and alcohol was confined to greater state control without being eliminated.
Well, you know, that's almost right, Brian.
How far off am I?
It actually came up in South Carolina in the 1890s.
Well, not so far off.
Well, it is pretty close in time. But the point being, Benjamin Tillman, sort of a great demagogue.
Oh, the pitchfork guy.
Ben Tillman, a one-eyed populist racist reformer in South Carolina. Would you think of him as a progressive, Brian?
No.
Well, his idea was really, you know, to regulate. He didn't think you could get rid of alcohol consumption. Yeah. But so the state, this is kind of like a precursor to the lottery today, right? The state might as well regulate it and make some money on it.
Make money off
revenue.
It.
Yeah. Revenue. No, that's very interesting because, of course, when we got national prohibition, who administered it, who was responsible, it was the Treasury. And the reason it was Treasury rather than justice, which was a more logical choice, was those Treasury people, they knew all about alcohol because they'd been collecting taxes on it for decades.
That's great.
So yeah. Ed really made terrific. Ed makes a terrific point.
Awesome.
But I don't think I'm that wrong. I'm going to stick by my guns.
No,
1890.
No. We'll work this on our own time. But thanks for calling. We really enjoyed the opportunity.
Thanks a lot.
Go to the party store, all right?
Okay.
Celebrate being on Backstory.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, guys, what this all points to is that the business of sin isn't just a boon for gangsters. It's big business for the government, too.
And Brian, it's been big from the beginning because the first time the new federal government tries to lay taxes, internal taxes, direct taxes, the excises, it's on whiskey, leading to a rebellion in western Pennsylvania. Because
that'd be the whiskey rebellion, wouldn't it?
Yeah, whiskey rebellion. Those freedom-loving farmers didn't want their distilleries taxed. Now, they couldn't get their wheat to market because transportation is so expensive, so they distill it all, and the government wants a take. And the result was the second coming of the American Revolution, because, of course, the American Revolution had been about taxes, including a tax on tea. And in 1794 is when Washington sent Hamilton out with the troops to western Pennsylvania to suppress the whiskey rebellion and to enforce order. So it's those things that we enjoy a lot, whether it's tea or whiskey. Government's going to take advantage of those appetites. And you can bet that government's going to be taxing sinful items throughout American history.
While telling us it's no good for us.
Absolutely.
But if you do bet on that, we'll tax you.
You got it.
Yeah, so there's this long history of this tension, right, between the moral well-being of society and the financial needs of the government. I mean, that's a contradiction that certainly wasn't lost on the pro-temperance crowd in the years after Prohibition's repeal.
Congress has passed a law putting $5 a barrel tax on beer. That means
that's Billy Sunday, one of the most famous evangelists of the early 20th century. Listen to him rail against the new taxes that Congress imposed in the aftermath of repeal.
They have put $2 of tax on whiskey, and they expect to realize $300 million. It doesn't take a lawyer to figure out that if you do that, you take that much money out of the legitimate channels of trade, you spend that much less for food and clothes and boots and shoes and education and automobiles. Oh, America didn't need repeal. She needed repentance. She didn't need rum. She needed righteousness. We don't need more grog. We need more God.
We don't need more grog. We need God. Well, in the long run, it looks like the forces of grog may have won out. At least that's the way it seemed to Catherine Moore, one of our producers, after her recent trip to Culpeper, Virginia. She was visiting Chuck Miller, a man who distills corn whiskey using the same recipe and the same copper kettle that his grandfather used back in the 1920s. The only difference is that Chuck has the government's blessing. He pays for the privilege and taxes, whereas Grandpa did it all under the table.
Where was your grandpa doing his thing?
Well, he was out of Fredericksburg. It's where he was born. They had a little farm on the other side of town there. He raised 11 kids and never had a job. They used to had a big old white house, you know, up on a hill. And he used to store what whiskey he did store, you know, was stored down in the cellar. And the only access to it was through the floor in the living room. And Grandma had one of those big rocking chairs with a skirt on it, you know. And every time they'd get raided, because they knew he had it, but they could never knew he was doing it, but they could never catch him, you know. She'd sit on that rocking chair on the trap door there and crochet. And they'd tear that place up. And they couldn't find anything. They did that several times. And she'd sit there the whole time they were tearing the house up and just crochet and rock. Yeah. I really wasn't interested in it. So I went away, you know, did my own thing for a while. But then when I got this farm and, you know, bills are high and trying to make a living farming, it's tough, you know. So got thinking about what he did, and I said, doggone, he made a lot of money, you know. But I didn't want to be illegal, so I called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Farms and told them what I wanted to do, and they said, sure, you can do it, but you got to fill out all this paperwork, you know. You have to tell them everything. Then they send an inspector by, and he checks out the amount of corn you used, the amount of whiskey you're making, the amount of bottles you had come in, how many bottles went out. You know, I mean, they got it all. They're allowed to break like 2% or something. You know, they've got it all figured out. They've been doing this a while. Yeah. And also, they also check the quality of the product you make. They come in, take samples, and they send them off to their lab. We got really good well water here to make whiskey. You know, it's a limestone water, and you need that to make a good mash. But you can't cut whiskey with limestone water because the minerals would come out, and then the whiskey would be cloudy, and then you couldn't pass a government test, see. So to clean up the water to cut the whiskey, we got to heat it, sand filter it, water softener, carbon filter, pre-filter, reverse osmosis filter, and I got a positive and a negative ion filter, 0.02 micron filter, and a UV light. You could probably guess Grandpa did not have any of that. I don't think he liked modern rules and regs, you know. I don't think he even cut it. He was one of them guys that liked working out in the woods by the creek. But that Virginia whiskey, you see that copper kettle, got to come back here and age for 2 years.
That's Chuck Miller, proprietor of Virginia Lightning Whiskey in Culpeper, Virginia.
When we get back, we'll hear from a therapist at a 12-step recovery program. Turns out, he doesn't care much for temperance either.
We'll also take more of your calls. Drop us a line. The number is 888-257-8851. More backstory coming up in a minute.
My daddy makes whiskey. My granddaddy did too. We ain't paid no whiskey tax since 1792.